LabCorp Perspectives Oncology, where we connect on cancer, science, and patient care. I'm your host, Dr. Rebecca Previs, and I'm a Director of Medical Affairs here at LabCorp. Today, we're speaking with my very good friend and colleague, Dr. Kyle Strickland, who is also a Director of Medical Affairs here at LabCorp, but also a board-certified pathologist by training. And we go way back. We've known each other and been working together since our days in academia at Duke in 2017. Kyle, admittedly, was my pathologist at the time in clinical practice that I had on speed dial. So I'm so thrilled that you're here with us today, Kyle.
Thanks, Becca. It's good to be here.
Awesome. Well, let's just start at the beginning in basics. Today, we're going to focus on ovarian cancer, which we know is our favorite topic to talk about because there's really so much unmet need. But let's start with what exactly is ovarian cancer and what does that actually mean? What does it include?
So ovarian cancer is really a broad term. When people talk about ovarian cancer, they're really addressing a spectrum of tumors that all look very different under the microscope and behave very differently in patients. Some tumors are thought to arise from the surface epithelium of the ovary, others from germ cells or stromal cells. Even within the epithelial tumors, we see subtypes like serous, mucinous, endometrioid, and clear cell. However, many of these tumors, which are termed ovarian cancer, actually originate outside of the ovary. For example, high-grade serous carcinomas, the most lethal subtype of ovarian cancer, they often begin in the fallopian tube. And it took nearly 250 years to prove that, and it's changed how we think about prevention and early detection of that disease. Other ovarian tumors can arise from endometriosis, which is an abnormal but non-malignant implantation of the endometrial epithelium from the uterus. And all that to say, when we talk about ovarian cancer, it's complicated, and you have to be very specific about which subtype you're talking about in the differential diagnosis.
You know, and ovarian cancer is often a misnomer. We talk about this a lot. What is it about then this cancer and the spectrum of cancers that you've just described that makes us call them ovarian cancer and what causes them to grow in the ovary?
That's a great question. So in many cases, the precursor malignant cells implant on the ovary from other nearby anatomic sites. It's believed that the ovarian microenvironment, maybe the hormones, the stroma, or some combination of the two, creates an exceptionally fertile ground for tumor growth. And this can be seen in metastatic cancers from other locations too. Oftentimes, they'll go to the ovary and start to grow. In gynecologic pathology, we place a very high priority on accurately classifying all of the ovarian tumors we see.
So it's starting in the fallopian tube, and really we can think of the ovarian cancer, you've used this metaphor before, as a launch pad. And it's also really important, as you described, to really think about ovarian cancer not just being one disease. We're broadly using kind of a grouping term here, but really, as you've already alluded to, there's so many different types. All of them behave a little bit differently, but I wanted to walk our listeners through that. What are some of the things that you see under the microscope that makes some of these ovarian cancers more aggressive than others?
So there's actually a whole spectrum of abnormal tissue growth that we see in the ovaries. So on one end, you have benign cyst adenomas, which aren't clonal or truly neoplastic. They arise from benign proliferations and then fluid accumulation. In the middle, we have what are called borderline tumors, and these are atypical and have complex growth patterns, but they tend to behave indolently. And then at the malignant end of the spectrum, we have our high-grade carcinomas, which are aggressive and often diagnosed at an advanced stage. So these malignancies, they can be mucinous, they can resemble endometrial cancers, especially when they arise from endometriosis, or they can be what we call serous. Now, outside of pathology, in the medical field, the term serous is often used to describe the color or nature of certain fluid collections, right? But in this context, this specifically refers to the histologic resemblance of the serous epithelium of the fallopian tube. And we think that this is where the majority of these serous ovarian tumors actually originate.
Yeah, I think that was always really hard for all of our patients to kind of grapple with, that most of these serous tumors are actually started in that fimbriated region of the fallopian tube. Now, I want to shift gears to what I think I could speak for both of us and say that homologous recombination deficiency is probably our favorite biomarker. And we abbreviate this as HRD for short, but we know it's complex. I want to break it down because this is a really hard biomarker to understand. What does it mean for our patients with ovarian cancer? Let's start there.
So HRD is definitely our favorite biomarker at the moment, and we'll get into a little bit about why, but You know, the term HRD really refers to a tumor's inability to repair double-stranded DNA breaks through the homologous recombination pathway. So the first clue that this was even important came from patients with germline BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations, because they're at higher risk for developing high-grade serous ovarian cancers. And over time, we learned that the BRCA proteins are key players in this homologous recombination DNA repair process. So I'm going to borrow an analogy that I've heard you use, and it's one that I really like. You can think of DNA damage like a cracked car windshield. In a normal cell, you take that car to the repair shop and get it fixed with factory grade glass, and that's homologous recombination. But in HRD, that repair shop is closed. So instead, the cell has to use duct tape, an error-prone makeshift repair mechanism. Over time, the duct tape fixes accumulate, they back up, you get more and more DNA mutations that leads to genomic instability and eventually cancer.
Yeah, I love that analogy because admittedly, I use duct tape for everything, but I think we can agree that it doesn't really work where cell DNA is concerned. We really need those high fidelity repair processes to keep our cells working the best they can. Now, here's where I want to call out something critically important clinically, and this is where the PARP or poly-ADP ribose polymerase PARP inhibitors come into play. And these targeted therapies have been a game changer in the ovarian cancer space. Really, they leverage the tumor's own vulnerability, making it highly efficacious, either therapy or maintenance for patients with ovarian cancer who have underlying BRCA1 or 2 mutations, or whose tumors have this element of HRD.
Absolutely. So the PARP protein itself plays a central role in that duct tape alternative DNA repair pathway system. So if a tumor is already HR deficient and you block these alternative repair pathways with a PARP inhibitor, the cancer cell can't repair the DNA at all. And we term this synthetic lethality. That's the theory that we call it. You can think of it like cutting off both escape routes. The cancers can no longer manipulate their DNA appropriately, and eventually the cancer cells will die.
And this is a rapidly evolving landscape, especially as we think about incorporating PARP inhibitors for these patients. It's really evolved over time in the years I've been in clinical practice. You know, initially when they were first approved, patients in the recurrent setting who were platinum resistant were primarily eligible, those with BRCA1 and 2 mutations. But with more data, clinical trials, frontline trials, we've really seen this big shift. So many of the recurrent treatment and maintenance options have been actually withdrawn to date. And now we're really evaluating all patients who are BRCA1 or 2 negative for homologous recombination deficiency to really inform if they could benefit from a PARP inhibitor maintenance. This space, again, has changed so rapidly. In fact, the FDA just recently updated its guidance again on the use of PARP inhibitors, specifically with niraparib. You want to walk us through that?
Sure. So the big shift is that niraparib is no longer recommended for all comers with ovarian cancer. And instead, their use is now more targeted, primarily for patients with HRD-positive tumors. So this change was driven by data showing limited benefit in HR-proficient tumors, as well as concerns about toxicity.
Now, you and I will admit that HRD is our favorite biomarker, primarily because, you know, at LabCorp, we've been working on an enhancement to one of our flagship assays, OmniSeq Insight. So why don't we share with our listeners about why we're so excited about HRD right now?
Absolutely. So we're really excited about this new enhancement to LabCorp's flagship NGS test, OmniSeq Insight. So this test will now include a genomic instability score and reports an HRD status as either positive or negative. And this gives an oncologist a clear picture of whether a patient's tumor is likely to respond to PARP inhibitors. And it's a step toward more personalized precision oncology.
That's right. And September is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month. And as we approach, you know, I think this will absolutely be another opportunity for us to talk about precision oncology. Now, let's talk about the other side of the coin, homologous recombination proficient or HRP tumors. For these patients, we really need better options. I know this is an area where you've spent a lot of time thinking about, especially in your research.
Absolutely. In my opinion, this is a critical area of unmet need in the ovarian cancer space. HR proficient or HRP tumors, they're more aggressive, and these patients often have shorter progression-free and overall survival. Moreover, they don't have a lot of the therapeutic options as other serous tumors because they do not benefit from PARP inhibitors.
So let's dive into your recently accepted study. In this study, you looked at a subset of these tumors, right? And really focused on another important biomarker, RB1.
That's right. I'm really proud of this publication that's going to happen in Scientific Reports. So RB1 is a classic tumor suppressor gene. And while its general function is very well understood, its role in ovarian cancer, especially high-grade serous carcinomas, it hasn't really been fully clarified. So interestingly, in some of these tumors, RB1 is lost, and paradoxically, that's associated with a better prognosis. In contrast, when RB1 is retained, outcomes tend to be worse. So although RB1 has been implicated in poor prognosis, it hasn't been coherently integrated into molecular classifications until now. In our study, we analyzed data from the TCGA and our OmniSeq Insight and found that HR-proficient tumors with intact RB1 expression had the worst outcomes of all of the groups. Their median overall survival was just under 36 months compared to over 50 months in tumors that were either HR-deficient or had lost RB1 expression.
And that's years. And I just want to call out what a striking difference that is. So for our scientific audience, tell us a little bit more and dive a little deeper into about those differences.
So what we found is that tumors with intact RB1, those that still express the RB1 protein, actually look very different at the molecular level compared to other ovarian cancers. So they have a unique gene expression pattern, which suggests that they're biologically distinct and could respond differently to treatments. And on the other hand, HR-proficient tumors that lost RB1, those looked a lot more like HR-deficient tumors in terms of their gene expression, survival outcomes, and molecular features. Now, I don't think RB1 itself is causing these poor outcomes. It's probably more of a marker or a signpost for a different kind of chromosomal instability that's happening in these tumors. And importantly, that instability seems to be separate from what we see in HRD.
So in a way, let me try to distill this down. RB1 expression could be a biomarker for worse outcomes in our patients with these HRP tumors.
Exactly. And not just that. So it's potentially a stratification tool for clinical trials for drugs that act on the RB1 pathway as well. For example, CDK4/6 inhibitors might be effective in RB1 intact tumors, indeed this high-risk patient population that we identified, but maybe not for those with RB1 loss. So understanding RB1 status could help guide future therapies.
Certainly an area for more preclinical drug development, future clinical trials. This is a really exciting space, and I know our listeners will be really excited to kind of think about these future opportunities. So we covered, again, a lot in just a really short amount of time, but, you know, you do a lot of sign out. I think you're in the Buffalo lab today where testing is performed for OmniSeq Insight assay. From your perspective as a pathologist, where do we go from here as a field?
So I think we need to continue refining our molecular subtyping of really all gynecologic cancers and ovarian cancer in particular. HRD status is a great start, but adding markers, simple markers that we can accurately identify, like RB1 expression, can help us better predict outcomes and even potentially tailor treatments. From a testing standpoint, assays like OmniSeq Insight are helping bring that information to the clinic, especially in the setting of this HRD enhancement.
Yeah, it's such an exciting time here at GYN Oncology and LabCorp. Kyle, thanks as always for sharing your insights, being a great colleague, research partner, and I just share your passion for this work. So thank you so much for joining us. I want to thank our listeners, and we hope you'll join us next time on LabCorp Perspectives Oncology.